to the Florida Specifier Podcast. This is Brett Cyphers, and I'm joined today by my co-hosts and fellow members of the Specifier Editorial Board. First, Jeff Littlejohn. He's with the National Stormwater Trust, On-Site Performance, and he's also a senior advisor at Adams & Reese Law Firm. I'm allowed to call you a senior advisor, correct?
I think that is technically my term.
Excellent. Next, we have Ryan Matthews. Ryan is an attorney and lobbyist with the Gray Robinson Law Firm, and an all-around great guy. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. And of course, we have our editor-in-chief, Patrick Gillespie, who is an advisor with the Adams & Reese Law Firm.
But not a senior advisor.
I think he ought to be a senior advisor.
Not old enough to be a senior advisor?
Oh.
You put in a...
Not enough gray.
You put in a word with the boss.
Once you hit 50, it's not a status of...
Congratulations.
...based on any capability... It's an age-based title. That's great.
On that note, it's great to be with you guys. Mm-hmm. Let's start out by talking about the elephant in the room. It's now, I think, recording. It's May the 23rd. People are receiving their papers in the mail this week, which is great. Jeff has his. That's the one that got crinkled. And that's good news. The bad news is a lot of that newspaper we were hoping would include information about a budget that got passed, and it hasn't. And so why don't we just start with you, Ryan, and kind of give listeners a kind of a snapshot of what's going on down the street here.
Well, as you said, it's May 23rd, and we don't have a budget yet for a fiscal year that is starting July 1st, which is a problem. Normally in weeks 8 to 9 of the legislative session, the two chambers would agree on budget allocations, which are those high-level spending amounts on various subject matters, whether it's education, healthcare, environment, transportation, et cetera. We yet to have those budget allocations agreed to. And the discord, if you will, is largely centered around tax cuts and sort of how much the legislature is going to cut taxes for Floridians, which is a good thing, ultimately. But the House has been pretty steadfast in that they would like, at first, what was a 0.75% reduction in the sales tax, the current sales tax, which is at 6%. That 0.75 reduction would create about a $5 billion budget shortfall over the coming years. And the Senate has been vocally opposed to putting future legislatures in that position.
And so, at this point, what we're dealing with is kind of just a standstill. I mean, the Senate has said that they have not extended beyond June 6th. And the House has said, we'll do this until June 30th if we want. There's also some rumors around in terms of what the governor might do if you push close to the edge of that cliff. Are you hearing the same ones regarding something akin to a continuing resolution in the federal government budgeting process and then special session it?
So I think there are a number of different paths that we could take. You're right in that, we don't even have a fundamental agreement on when the budget will be ready. The Senate has said that we would have a budget and budget conference prior to June 6th. The House has actually come to Tallahassee 2 weeks ago now and passed a concurrent resolution unilaterally saying that we would extend until June 30th. So there's been no movement from the Senate's point at this juncture that says they will agree to that extension until June 30th. So as we sit here again, May 23rd with Memorial Day weekend, this weekend, it's very unlikely that we have any legislative activity the week after Memorial Day. So you're already looking at June 6th and the week of that week to actually commence the work. Now, to your point, we had what everyone thought was an agreement, and then the governor came out publicly saying that he would veto a budget that included a significant sales tax reduction because he has been focused very publicly on potentially property tax reductions and potentially complete abolition. So that certainly thrown some things into the mix. Whether or not we have the Senate that agrees to the House's position that we extend until June 30th, or they come to Tallahassee and say we will not do that, and then we have a subsequent special session simply for the budget, we don't yet know, but we do know we have a looming deadline of July 1st for this new fiscal year to start. And I think once prior in 1992, potentially, we had a budget that was not adopted and implemented until after July 1st that obviously will cause, you know, some issues with a $112 to $117 billion budget, depending on where we end up.
I think the idea is also that maybe creates, you know, this a game of chicken that gets a little too close, you know, a little too deep, I should say, into hurricane season. And, you know, a lot of them have, you know, been on the later side, but we have early, you know, hurricanes once in a while. And that could create some issues in terms of you press it, you press your luck a little too far and, you know, and then try to figure out how to catch up when something bad happens.
It is troublesome that we've had, at the federal level at least, some significant discussion about what FEMA will look like moving forward. I will say, to the credit of the governor and the Florida legislature, we have, you know, robustly funded the state's reserves over the past 6 years. And so I think we would be well positioned for this hurricane season. Obviously, you would diminish reserves that had been put into place. But, you know, depending on how things shake out at the federal level and what an agency looks like in FEMA or some form or fashion moving forward, that's obviously still potentially problematic with the number of hurricanes we've had.
And on that point, you know, I think where this House-Senate kind of debate is going back and forth on the budget, the Senate has kind of talked about that very thing. There's some uncertainty of what funding is going to be in play from the federal government because the state's government does rely on federal funding. And so with some uncertainty on how that's all going to play out, I think a lot of the discussion, there's a lot of balls in the air, right? And I think a lot of the discussion is around how do you cut so deep not knowing if there's going to be further cuts that you're not aware of yet. And so I think a lot of the back and forth has been centered around that theme.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point, great thing to bring up. Let's move away from, I'll call it a temporary failure to come to something and talk about some of the successes, because, you know, the main part of session is over. They finished on May the 2nd, and they sent some bills to the governor. We've even had a few bills that have been signed into law by the governor. Let's talk a little bit about a few of them that you may have noticed over the course of session that maybe we've worked on. And Jeff, I want to start with you because it's, you know, something you and I are very familiar with, and that's the passage of Senate Bill 796 by Senator Bradley. Its House sponsor is Bill Connerly. Why don't you talk about that a little bit and where that puts us?
It was a great team effort, Brett, and we appreciate all your effort helping us getting that done. So the Distributed Wastewater Treatment System bill creates a statutory general permit, which greatly streamlines the permitting process to get DWTS programs stood up and permitted. This is a new type of governance and process to get rid of septic tanks, and we need new tools in the toolbox, and I think the bill sponsors were appreciative of bringing new ideas forward, and they were happy to support it. They all did both of them did a great job getting it through the process. And we had a little bit of discussion through, you know, one committee, but mostly it was, you know, all high fives and thumbs up as we went through, which was great. So it's through the House and Senate. We're waiting on it to be presented to the governor's office. I think we've had some conversations with the governor's office. They seem all, you know, gung-ho to get it through. We worked with DEP early on with the language, and they were supportive of the language. And, you know, in fact, we're already talking to them about some rulemaking that's going to accompany this that will be rolled out here soon.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's like, you know, typically when you work on some legislation, you want to just be smooth sailing. You just want it to happen. Everybody's happy. No one ever asks a question or hits a no vote or, you know, anywhere along the way. But I think the one committee where you had some of that, we'll call it dissension, questioning, I think gave an opening for some pretty interesting public policy statements on the part of a few members. And I'm thinking not just of the House sponsor himself, Bill Connerly, but from Representative Mooney, Representative Maggard, who is, you know, also at the governing board of the Southwest Florida Water Management District. And it's the idea that because you're doing something new doesn't mean that you have to be suspicious of it. The whole idea of water quality improvement is to seek innovation to do it better and better and better. And so I was gratified to see the conversation turn in that direction in that meeting. And I don't think we would have heard that specifically from those lawmakers otherwise.
I agree. That it was fascinating to listen to that little bit of debate there. And I want to, you know, give some more kudos to Rep. Connerly, who really did a fantastic job defending the positions laid out in the bill. And then one of my favorite lines ever, when somebody was saying, isn't there only one company that could do this? Aren't we concerned about creating something that's proprietary? And Rep. Connerly said, no. I'm a environmental engineer. I could build this thing.
Yeah.
You know, there isn't anything special. I thought that was great. It was a great response. And we really appreciate all the work he did on that bill.
Did you guys get any no votes on that bill?
We did. In that committee, we got
in
two.
In committee. Not
really?
There.
All my bills pass unanimously. It's weird.
Well, I'm not a professional lobbyist like you, Ryan. And, anyway, but we wouldn't have had as much fun if it was all thumbs up and high fives.
Very right. True.
We'll talk about one of your success stories then, Ryan.
Well, I have a couple. No big deal, but
with no votes.
Two in particular that I worked on this year. One, actually, the governor signed into law yesterday, Senate Bill 1386 by Senator Clay Yarborough and House Bill 857 by Representative Jennifer Kincart Johnson, dealing with utility worker assault protection. There's been a disturbing trend, not just in Florida, but nationally, about utility workers in the field being accosted and or confronted through various means. And so we had some legislation that was unfortunate but necessary, again, that would have increased criminal penalties for any assault or battery on a utility worker while they were in the course of their employment working on critical infrastructure. So, obviously sort of a feel-good policy, but one that is protective. I didn't necessarily anticipate any no votes on that. But again, it's trying to make sure that those who are keeping our lights on and our water running protected. So that was one. I was very impressed with Representative Kincart Johnson, who was a freshman from the Lakeland area. She did just tremendously shepherding the bill through the process, as did Senator Yarborough. But we have had the occasion to work with Senator Yarborough before, and he's very good as a sponsor as well. The second one deals with brownfields, and this was a bill that Senator Keith Trunow sponsored in the Senate and Representative Adam Anderson sponsored in the House. This was sort of a much needed update to the brownfields program at DEP, and much like you and Jeff, we worked with the department on the front end to make sure that they felt comfortable with the changes that we were making. We had moved a date by which entities were eligible to participate in the brownfields program from, I think, 1975 to 2025, which would allow for mitigation of, emerging contaminants like PFAS, PFOA, as well as that's going to be a major focus in years forthcoming. But we also just sort of programmatic changes that seem much needed and overdue, whereas if you have a large parcel that is contaminated or is requiring cleanup and there are multiple owners within that large parcel, this bill would allow for individual owners to enter the program as opposed to waiting for every owner within that plume to do so. So really just speeding up development and trying to emphasize the need to continue the good work that the Brownfields program does.
Let's turn to one that had some controversy that carried with it. It made it past the finish line, but not without more no votes than Jeff and I experienced in the bill that we were working on. And that's Senate Bill 492. That's the mitigation bill. And it was pretty significant in terms of what they were accomplishing there. Who wants to kind of give the nickel tour of that one?
Not everybody at once.
Well, I'll kick it off. It just seems like essentially you're talking about expanding not just the out of basin framing of what credits you can get for mitigation, but also out of kind mitigation credits. And it expanded that quite a bit.
It did indeed. And I didn't work on it, but I was watching it all the way through. And the provisions that you just described were significant departures from longstanding policy at the state that it had to be in kind, had to be in basin or else. I think the recognition that the mitigation bank credits are not keeping up with the development demand just finally, reached critical mass to the point where there's a willingness to provide some mechanism to still utilize the credit marketplace even if there weren't credits in your basin. So the premium that the state applied to the use of out-of-basin credits, so you get more credits if you have to go out-of-basin than in-basin. I think that that's a, you know, makes sense. It's common sense. It also is consistent with federal mitigation credit, you know, bank credit policy right now. So it not only opens it up, but it also matches the federal process. And I think that made some sense too and helped get it through. Anybody notice conservation easement language? I thought that was interesting to see it kind of, you know, first start as a standalone bill and then get amended on at the 11th hour. I thought that was very interesting policy. Anybody had any experience with that directly? Why that was added on? I mean, I heard some anecdotes, but.
No, I didn't have experience, and I didn't work on this bill in particular, although Brett, you and I did some mitigation banking legislation the year prior. But Jeff, to your point, I mean, it's sort of normal course of practice that as session is going along, if you have a standalone bill that may have reached some obstacle for some reason or other, that it will be attached to another piece of legislation that's moving, so long as the subject matter isn't too egregiously outside the scope of what the original bill was discussing. And I think that was just a matter here. I mean, I think we had a significant push to revamp the mitigation banking sort of world in Florida, and like you said, align with some of those federal regulations, and the conservation easement language which is also timely and obviously been a big focus for, you know, DACs and other agencies here. My guess is that you'll see more conservation easement language or legislation next session too.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of the train, you know, the things that kind of move around, you know, like the peas under the coconut shell halves, or find some metaphor in there somewhere to describe that. And typically it's the transportation bills, and this year was no exception to that rule. I was grateful enough to be working on an issue for a local regional voting rights group, and was grateful enough that Senator Trumbull and Representative Griffiths with Senate Bill 1388, which is the, you know, the voter freedom bill. That was also something that was touted by the governor, and that was signed, and that ended up including one of those items that we were fortunate enough to get on there, which was something that not only protected voters from some of these primary issues of being, you know, boarded by law enforcement and other safety issues. It actually dealt with how we go about the enforcement, the promulgation of spring protection zones throughout Florida. And a lot of times these things deal with quality issues, and that's what we have in our minds when it comes to vessel activity. A lot of these places are a lot more remote than others, and the way that the rule and statute originally was written was just a little bit vague, a little bit undercooked, and it didn't give Fish and Wildlife the tools it needed to make decisions that fit a particular place at a given time. And the folks that I worked with were, I wouldn't call them the victims of that, but I would say the on the receiving end of something that was not the right tool in the right place. And so it's just one of those examples of, fortunately, of good language making onto a really great bill and, you know, and being successful. With that, let's move to the paper itself. Patrick, talk a little bit about the front page, and also if you can, maybe describe a little bit how difficult it is when you have a moving target like a session that doesn't seem to ever end, and you're trying to get news in there related to what's going on there when we're only doing this every 2 months.
Yeah, that's the challenge with not having a daily or a weekly publication. We actually moved our deadline a little bit further back to accommodate what we intended or thought was going to be the end of session, and obviously still missed the mark. So we do have one story in there that captures some of the activity that occurred. Obviously, we had plans for a much more robust coverage, which would have been multiple stories, including a budget story, which still to this day nobody can write because we don't know what that's going to be. So we will update the website. We'll update floridaspecifier.com. And so I would say for people listening to this today, when the news does come out, go there for updates, and we'll continue to update the website. So it is a bit of a challenge. Just had to shift some things around and move some other things up. And so we were able to get a really cool story about how one of the water management districts is using GIS technology to help with some of their projects. I'll say I've always been kind of a nerd on where technology and environment and energy sort of intersect, and so I always like those types of stories. We had a cool one in there about kind of there's a big sort of data center row outside of Washington, D.C., which makes a lot of sense given all the federal agencies and the data that they have to process, that all decided, not all, but a good chunk decided to go on generator power. And so what were the effects of that on the utilities that provide the energy in that area? And so it was kind of an interesting read to sort of look at what the effects of that are and then potentially kind of what that would mean for Florida, obviously, which is positioned well with a large landmass to be able to kind of move in the data center space and provide some of that same technology. There's just some unknown challenges that you might not have thought of. So cool story there. And then, I like that we're providing some updates about what's going on in the federal space and how that's going to affect Florida. Obviously, some key former DEP staff are now in key EPA positions, which is great for Florida. And then you've got other rulings coming out of and policy coming out of the Washington agencies and how that's affecting what goes on in Florida. So I think a good mix of local, state, federal news, which is always, I think, a good place for us to be.
Yeah, and I think when I say like every 2 months we put the actual paper out, that is true. It's like, but you also... And the specifier also makes changes to the website itself, which is floridaspecifier.com. Or you also can find more up-to-date, more timely news in your newsletter that comes out every Monday morning, where you're tracking a lot of these stories, where we're covering a lot of these stories. And I'm thinking especially you and Jeff on some of these federal issues, because they seem to be popping at a pretty good clip over the last year or so, and that's another way for folks to find out some of these things that they may not read, in the normal places.
That's right. Yeah. And obviously, if you're really interested in kind of a niche subject like the environment or like energy, there's not that many publications that are really focused on state-specific, policy-specific information like we are. So to your point, Brett, we are trying to update the website as frequently as possible as news breaks and trying to get that out. Anyone can sign up for our weekly newsletter at the website, and certainly there's you can subscribe on the website as well to make sure that you get those articles without any sort of paywall. So all options to stay in the know.
Brett, why don't you talk a little bit about? I know you had a couple articles that you were looking at this issue. What were some of your favorites?
I've only been looking at one, Ryan, but I thank you for asking about that because I am sawing away at the issue, and it's regarding the status under the Endangered Species Act for the Florida scrub jay. And I don't particularly have an opinion one way or the other on the subject. I like that the subject of federalism as it relates to how something, whether it be a species or something else, exists within just one state and how the federal government gets involved in that, I think is an interesting argument to keep an eye on. My real opinion, though, is regarding its status as the Florida state bird or songbird or whatever the heck we're doing at this point. All I can say is I am a mockingbird hater, and so I'm very encouraged by, yes.
So you do have an opinion.
Breaking news.
I have an opinion about mockingbirds, and so in relation to the scrub jay is obviously a better choice for the state bird. I think the flamingo is fine. I think the legislation that they tried to pass this year regarding making the flamingo the state bird and the scrub jay the state songbird, I believe is how they differentiated the two. I think that is good public policy. And so anything to get the scrub jay out there to displace the mockingbird, I'm all for. So thank you for bringing that forward, Patrick.
We'll get with Representative Mooney. We'll make sure that you can testify next session.
Pro bono. I'm on it. What do you think, Ryan?
I'm just fascinated by your mockingbird hatred and your love for scrub jays. But you learn something new about people every day.
When I graduated from college at Florida State, I went to college. At first, I was at University of South Florida. I walked from close to the Sun Dome over to the social science building. Every single day, this is in the spring at one point, every single day I walk by this small tree, there's no way of getting around it, and every day, mockingbird swooping in at me, pecking at my head, and that stuck with me, guys.
You're victimized.
That stuck with
me. You were victimized.
You're targeted.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh.
It all makes sense.
Well, I actually, there's a couple articles that I did enjoy. Obviously, have been focused on water supply for majority of my career. So some good articles there, but also kind of want to just piggyback a little bit on Patrick's favorite article as it relates to data centers and their potential in the state of Florida. I do represent a number of large municipal utilities, and there's a lot of conversation going on about the future of data centers in Florida. Simply from, you know, a generation of electricity standpoint, a transmission of electricity standpoint, and then, you know, load requirements that these data centers have, it is expansive and significant. And so I think it'll be interesting how that conversation plays out over the next couple of years. To Patrick's point, you know, Florida is an attractive place for all businesses, but certainly because of our landmass for these particular data centers. But the question becomes whether or not we can handle the electric load that comes with them as well. So that was an article that I really enjoyed too. Jeff, what about you?
This is a good news, bad news segment for me. So on the good news side, I was happy to help with the WOTUS article. Patrick admitted he's a bit of a nerd. I'm definitely a nerd when it comes to WOTUS, and I've been following this issue since all the flip-flopping happening between the different administrations. And so it's nice to see the new administration come out early with a fast and inside pitch on this issue with some new guidance that I couldn't stop laughing when I saw the name of the new memo announced by the EPA administrator called WOTUS Notice, the Final Response to SCOTUS, which I appreciate. So it you know, this is getting into the weeds. You need to read the article, but they're taking on the continuous service connection component of WOTUS. It's still been kind of custom discussed after the Sackett case. They seem to be eliminating discrete features as a way of severing jurisdiction. I think it's going to cause a constraining of federal jurisdiction. Hasn't going to have any effect on state jurisdiction of wetlands, but it will have an effect on federal jurisdiction of wetlands. That's going to be something we'll continue to cover. There was a solicitation of public comments to announce as well. That public comment period closed with like 36,000 comments. There's going to be some more rulemaking. So that's something we'll continue to cover. The bad news is I couldn't get it past the editor-in-chief to put in an article about the Gulf of America. I had some great ideas for a story. I'm not gonna talk anymore. I'm still disgruntled. Save it for another time.
Tune in.
There's no response. I mean, that's a terrible idea for a story. It has nothing to do with the environment either.
I think we can attribute some of the cleverness of the WOTUS memo to Jess Kramer.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We're all counting on her to bring this in for a landing.
Oh. Yep, indeed.
All right, well, let's talk quickly about the calendar. And I don't want to stick with one item. And if you want to see what's going on around the state in the coming weeks and months, feel free to visit the website. It's there. Go to the specifier paper itself. It's in there. What I'd like to cover, because we're not going to get that opportunity, I don't think, before it's upon us, is summer school, the environmental permitting summer school. And this is, you know, Jeff and you, Ryan's your baby. It changes and evolves every year. It's the Super Bowl of environmental conferences. Everybody goes to it. Everybody looks forward to it. My family personally looks forward to going. There's a lot of value, but I think part of what makes it really good is that you're constantly looking for ways to improve it. And so give us a little idea of where we left it, say this past summer and going into this July. Talk about when it is, some of the things that people can look forward to. I think I asked this the last time we tried to record this, was can people still participate if that is their wish? But maybe tackle a couple of those things for me.
I'm happy to, Brad. So first, some relatively minor structural changes. You may not even notice it, but over the last few years, we've struggled with some of the courses not having enough room for people who want to get in there. So some of our rooms have been on the small side and the interest has been on the high side. And so to deal with that, we have consolidated some room space to make the classrooms bigger. The result is we will only have 9 options for each block of instruction instead of the usual 10 that we've had for decades now. So we're down slightly on the number of options in each time slot. You won't notice a drop in the diversity of the content or even the total number of classes. We ended up taking up some slack by taking some classes that we were teaching twice and only teaching them once, or taking some classes that were in two-part classes and knock them down to one. But there's still a lot of fresh content, a lot of new courses this year. We've revamped some courses, but you'll have some bigger rooms, and hopefully that will help address some of the congestion.
How about new sponsors? I think we got a couple new sponsors.
Yeah, we've seen another growth in sponsorship this year, which of course is fantastic. We like to think that there's a clear value in sponsoring and being there, and we, you know, appreciate all of our sponsors. We had a new sponsor this year just pop up on our radar a couple of weeks ago. Cedron Technologies is in the biosolids technology space. Patrick loves new tech and environmental overlap, and this is clearly that. So they're going to be down there speaking and sponsoring this year. We appreciate them. So it's there. We would say it's never too late to join the team. Maybe too late now to get a speaking spot. We're just about completely packed in terms of total number of speakers.
Yeah, and to that end, you know, Brett, we've got over 70 courses, about 1,100 attendees. It is our 39th annual Environmental Permitting Summer School. July 15th through the 18th are those dates. And, you know, like last year, if you as a sponsor or an attendee have a desire to potentially record a podcast down there, you and I moved in for all intents and purposes downstairs and recorded about a dozen podcasts last summer school. And we'd love to do that again and really think it provides a forum for individuals and companies to let people know what they're doing and how they're doing it. And we hope that many will take us up on that opportunity.
Yeah, and that even includes, I think you and I are going to team up to record one of the sessions where you'll be joined by your former and I think current DEP secretary colleagues, and I'll be the fly on the wall trying to ask coherent questions along with you, right?
That's news to me. I'm thrilled. I can't wait to do that. That's going to be great.
Breaking news.
Okay.
The secretary... What are we calling it? A round table?
Fireside chat.
Fireside chat. Okay. That's right.
I love it.
Yep.
Like a luau fireside chat.
Okay.
No fire inside the
Only
building.
If Steverson is the fire juggler who performs at Marco. We're going to have to make that happen.
It'll be good. But also, if you want to record beforehand, let either myself or Ryan know. Glad to hook up with you. And that way people can hear about you before you get there.
What's going on? I do want to hear before we get out of here and celebrate the Memorial Day weekend. What's going on with Water for Fighting? Who do you have coming up there?
I'm trying to close out season four here. And so I've got the great good fortune of folks that are exiting as their lobbyists, but they will remain friends, you know, for here till I don't get to have friends anymore. And that's Justin Friedman, who is the general manager of Res, as well as Desmond Duke, who is an awesome guy to talk to and share a drink with. And so I'll get to record with both of them. You and I actually recorded Justin at summer school last year. And so I'll do a deep dive on his story and Desmond's story. Also going to record with I think he's great, semi-controversial professor out of University of Florida named Kevin Folta, who is a big defender of science defended uses of ways to modify foods to human beings' benefit. So that sometimes that's the use of glyphosate and as people I think typically call it Roundup. And so that'll be a really interesting conversation. Look forward to hearing from him. Probably hear a lot about it after the fact, but he has his own podcast, which is also really good if you like to nerd out on biotech stuff. And
that sounds kind of Rogan-esque in your fearless tackling of the issues. I love it.
I like to hear people's stories. Sometimes they're super controversial, like Ryan, and sometimes, you know, they're a little easier. But we take them as they come. I like how you pretended like you're not controversial sometimes, but that's fun.
The engineer who's been practicing law, pseudo law, for two decades.
Oh, and I shouldn't forget one of my new employers, Brian Henry, who's the president of Sea and Shoreline. He actually is from North Carolina, and he's such a great guy and an interesting guy. And he and I've got to know each other when they were a client of mine. Now that I'm an employee, it'll be fun to get a chance to really get to know him better as well. So,
well, excellent, and congrats on the new gig. Well, I think that about covers it. Thanks for listening to the Florida Specifier podcast. If you like what you hear, please be sure to hit subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen. And don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. If you don't like what you hear, it's definitely Brett's fault. This is the second time we've recorded this podcast. So do be sure to let him know, but don't hold it against the rest of us. I recommend subscribing to the Florida Specifier online at floridaspecifier.com and read your environmental news and commentary the new, old-fashioned way. But do be sure to subscribe. It's easy, inexpensive, and offers a ton of ways to read, watch, listen, and learn at your fingertips. Your support is greatly appreciated.
Production of this podcast is by Carl Sorn and David Barfield at Lonely Fox Studios. We want to thank Bagels and Biscuits for letting us use their music for the podcast. Join us next time as we delve into the issues, policy, and people that environmental professionals and policymakers want to know about. For Jeff Littlejohn, Ryan Matthews, and the always terrible Brett Cyphers, I'm Patrick Gillespie, and we'll see you next time.